I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Frody is off somewhere being Mr. Cool, so he won't be with us today. We are going to begin, as usual, by thanking our donors. This year, we're trying to raise $100,000, and we have now raised $56,422.79. I'd like to thank Albert for $500, Tony for $100, Kathleen for $70 a month, Mark for $100.77, Rose for $20 a month, AH for $100, OM for $50, Ezra for $14.88, CS for $30, CS for $16 a month, Jordan for $10 a month, CM for $100, Albert for $1,000. I'm not sure if that's the same Albert. If it is, we're really bowled over by our generosity. $1,000 is very, very generous. Alex for $30, and somebody who's totally anonymous for $99.91. So thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody. I mean, I find that in this age of social media, it gives us on the dissident right a lot more opportunities than we had in earlier periods. But at the same time, one of the problems I see in it is that it makes us so far removed from each other. So, I mean, I see the statistics and I know people are reading the articles on the site and they buy our books, but you know, we don't know who most of you are. But this is a concrete way that those of you out there who value our stuff show your appreciation. And that's, I can't overestimate how much of a morale boost it really is to see people who are willing to do that.
Yeah, I agree. We now have had 393 donations in this fundraiser, so that's a tremendous amount of support. Some of those donations are from the same people over and over again who are just especially generous. But when you think about how many people come to Countercurrents every month, I just looked at our statistics, and right now we have almost 90,000 unique visitors who have come to the website. And today's the 13th. So that's quite a lot of people. And of those 90,000 people, only a few have donated. Last month, we had almost 200,000 unique visitors. So there are fewer than 400 people who are keeping Countercurrents on the air coming in. So we really want to thank you. Many, many people are benefiting from your generosity. So let's talk about some more of these normie questions. It's a very popular format for the podcast. And so I have gathered together six new questions, and I'd like to just run through them with John, and we'll discuss them. And the first one, I'm just springing this on John. I didn't share it with him earlier. A friend of ours asked if we thought that the term replacist would be a good meme. Because people are constantly calling us racists. They're saying, oh, what a horrible racist idea. And that's supposed to be like one of those crime stop words from Orwell that sort of freezes thought in its tracks. You're a racist. You can't think those horrible things. You're a racist. You're immoral. Well, our enemies are quite openly campaigning for race replacement. And replacist is sort of a nice short epithet that we can use to describe what they are. I actually think it's a fairly good meme.
You know, I think it is. My only problem with it would be that it refers to a negative. You know, refers to something that we oppose.
Well, yeah,
rather than something that we stand for.
Well, yeah, but the point is that when people say you're a horrible racist, they're calling you out for doing something they oppose, and we do need words to describe the people that we oppose. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think it's a short.
Oh, then so this is the word that we would apply to
them.
Yeah, okay, then in that case, yeah, that's yeah, I like that.
Yeah, okay. They're e-racists. They want to erase us. But I think it's good to have new terms and new memes circulating around to describe what our opponents are really about. I think the great replacement is a really good term for what's going on. And I think replacist is a nice term to describe an adherent or advocate of the Great Replacement.
Although I also think, in Guillaume Faye's book, which, I think other than archaeofuturism was his best one, Why We Fight, one of the words, there's two that I love in there. One is mental aids, which is a term he likes to apply to people who engage in this kind of postmodern liberal thought. But also ethnomasochist, I think, is the best one.
That's
a great word for these people. But it's in the same spirit as replacist. But not as catchy as replacist.
replacist is broader because it can refer to people who are not our ethnic group and who are very much opposed to our continued existence, whereas an ethnomasochist really is just one of our own people who's basically bought the white guilt trip and is circling around the drain, basically, because they are so full up with white guilt. Another person wrote, this is a friend in Portugal. He asked, one of the main issues is, why should we be concerned about the existence of the white race? This is a question that he gets.
Well, that's almost like asking, well, why should you care about your family? Or
Why should you care about yourself, even?
I mean,
you'd have to be... Basically, this is the kind of question that only makes sense to somebody who's, like, contemplating suicide. You know, why should I continue to exist? I mean, people do contemplate that question. But I think that we have to recognize that you would only contemplate that question if you're in an extremely unhealthy frame of mind.
Or very disconnected from reality.
Yeah.
I'd say, if you're so wrapped up in yourself that you don't see any value in your own people.
Right, exactly. And I think that the first thing that you have to say when this question is posed is to identify it as an unhealthy question. That's a morbid, unhealthy question. No healthy person would contemplate the oblivion of their race with equanimity. That is like contemplating suicide or something like that. And we recognize that when people contemplate their own deaths, that's not generally a sign that they're in a good state of mind.
Well, I would also say it's sort of the extreme end of liberalism. I mean, when you put the individual at the center of everything, and the individual is the be-all and end-all, as our current societies do in the West, that's inevitably where you go up, where you think, well, why should I care about anyone other than myself? It's a false philosophical premise, because no matter who you are, you come from somewhere. You came into existence within a particular biological and cultural context. You're part of a tradition, whether you like that or not. I think it's just based on a false premise, because it assumes that the individual can be... I could see why a non-white person might ask that question, but if you're white yourself, it's just crazy, because it presents a false idea of who you are as you, as something that's disembodied from everything that produced you over the millions of years of... biological and cultural inheritance that you were born with, that you're somehow separate from that, and you can choose to just accept it or leave it.
Yeah. Why should we be concerned about the existence of the white race? Well, because it's ours, basically, is my answer. We should be concerned about our own existence. We should be concerned, though, about who came before us and who comes after us. We're not isolated individuals. If we're really serious about the things that we love, then the things that we love don't have value simply insofar as we're alive. That would be a kind of subjectivist view of things. If you think that things are of value, you want other people to carry on those things, carry them forward. So if you're really serious about life and about meaning, you can't just confine it to your own individual existence. That leads to a kind of extreme subjectivism and detachment. You really have to be concerned about who's going to carry these ideas forward into the future, who's going to carry the things that you value into the future. The things that you care about will perish if there's no one around to care about them. But I do think that people can only contemplate that with equanimity if they're somehow depressed, or if they're somehow intoxicated, literally poisoned with negative feelings like white guilt propaganda, stuff like that. That really is a sign of a person who has already bought a lot of this white guilt propaganda. Of course, if somebody were to say, why should we be concerned about the existence of the Jewish race? You know, that's practically a hate crime just to raise that question. Why should we be concerned about the existence of the black race? There are lots of white people who would jump forward, scramble forward to provide reasons why we should care about other races than our own. And again, that's a manifestation of something deeply unhealthy. Why should we be concerned about the existence of the tiger or the snail darter or the whales?
That's true. There's plenty of white people who are more concerned about the extinction of certain species than they are about ourselves.
Yeah, other species than ourselves. Yeah. And I honestly think that that's a good way to put it in context, is to say, well, you know, why should we be concerned with the existence of any race?
Yes.
Most people would not be blasé about saying, let's contemplate a world without Jews. Let's contemplate a world without Chinese or the Japanese or Africans. Let's contemplate that world. Would that be a better or worse place? Why should we be concerned about that? People are very concerned about biodiversity on the planet. And yet if they ask that question, well, I think that there's, how to put it, they're not being real. They're either really depressed or they're being inauthentic, they're being fake. They're being politically correct. They're asking and entertaining a question that they would never ask and entertain about any other group of people on the planet.
Although I also feel like, connected to what I was saying before, another way that this question can come about is from people who say, well, I don't see race, I just see individuals.
Right.
You know, people who, I mean, usually it's being disingenuous, because often these people will say that about people of other races, but when it comes to somebody who sees himself as, you know, actually believes in a future for our own people, that's seen as somehow negative and a problem.
Right.
It needs to be stopped. But you know these people who say, oh, I just see individuals. I don't see people. But that's just a completely false intention.
It's a false view of the self and morality. And it's also fake on their own parts, because we know that if they're normally constituted organisms, they have built-in biases for people who are genetically similar to them. This is just the way that we're built. That's how we're wired. So another question that we got, I'll just read the whole thing. Hi, Greg. This isn't a normie question I get asked, but more a question I often consider. Raising a good family that continues our traditions, our religion, and our culture is difficult. Finding a partner that believes what you believe and doing your best to live a traditional, wholesome lifestyle is hard work. Extending help and support to your extended family so that they can do the same is demanding. Is this work the equivalent of activism? Or put more simply, is it enough, or should I be trying to do more? What I hear here is an acknowledgement of the fact that in a decaying anti-white society, it takes often heroic efforts just to be normal.
Yes.
Just to have a normal life, just to keep promises and do things that your parents' generation and grandparents' generation and on into the past found normal and easy, and they didn't have to go against the grain of society to do these things. So isn't just leading a normal life revolution enough? Isn't just sort of treading water just revolution enough? And I would say yes and no. It is something that we have to recognize, and this is one of the problems that we face. You have to be more than normal to lead a normal life these days. You have to have superhuman efforts. You know, this is sort of reminds me of the question about single mothers. You know, people say, are you frowning on single mothers? And it's like, well, I recognize that single mothers have to do a whole lot of hard work to raise a normal kid. Because I know that if I added up all the support and time and money and things like that that I got from my parents growing up and then cut it in half, definitely would have affected my life. And if I had only one parent, then I know that that one parent would have to be working extra hard to make up for the lack of a second one. And you don't want to denigrate people for doing that, but at the same time, you want to say, well, that's, how to put it, you don't want to applaud, you don't want to denigrate them. You want to recognize that they're actually doing quite a lot, but they shouldn't have to be doing all that extra. They shouldn't have to be heroes just to be normal. And people shouldn't have to make heroic efforts just to have a normal life, but that's one of the problems of living in a decaying society. And I congratulate people who are doing that. And then the question is, well, should they do more? Should they do more politically? And I would have to say yes. I'd have to say yes for the simple reason that if we don't change the political trends that are making white life increasingly difficult today, then raising a good family and making sure that they that they're born and educated and off to a good start in life, well, you're going to be bequeathing a worse world and a greater struggle for your kids. And so in a way, it's almost dereliction to simply say, well, I raised my kids well and I did all the things that normal families do, and that's enough. If you know that present trends continued, you're bequeathing them a more difficult life than you have had. Yes. So I think we all have to, you know, do our best at lead normal lives. And in fact, I think we all have to try and lead exemplary lives. We have to be good people. We have to be the best versions of ourselves.
And we have to embody the values that we advocate for.
Yeah, as much as possible.
I'm not going to name names, but there's a lot of people in our circles who don't, quite honestly. And this ends up reflecting badly on all of us.
Well, yeah, exactly. And we have to try and be the best possible versions of ourselves. And then we have to do a little bit more on top of that to change the political trends that are so negative and so destructive of white life. And so I congratulate this person. I think you're doing great work. I don't want to denigrate what you're doing in any way, but I do think that we all have to do more. And if we don't do more, then the next generation is going to have it even harder.
Well, the task before us is enormous, and everybody has to give as much as they can. I mean, some people are in more of a position to do that than others. I understand that. But I think you're right. Although the point about family kind of reminds me a little bit. There's this meme I saw not long ago, which I think I haven't seen it, but I think it's a still from 50 Shades of Grey. But this guy's talking to a woman. He says, "My tastes are somewhat unconventional." And then the next scene is a photo of just an ordinary white family with a mother and a father and three kids.
I've seen that too. I think that's really hilarious.
And that's true. That is almost a revolutionary act in today's culture.
What a perversion. Yeah. What an exotic, perverse mentality. You just want to have like a normal life. I've seen a version of that meme where instead of a normal family, there's like a yard full of Pekingese puppies. All sort of looking with big eyes, you know. It's just hilarious. I have rather unusual taste. Yeah. But I do think that we have to be fair. Yes, it's great to do this, to have a traditional wholesome family, and it's harder and harder to do this, and yet, in addition to all that, I think we all have to do a little extra to try and make the world a better place, not only for our own kids, but for everybody's kids, for the future generations of our race. So yeah, and part of my role in this movement is to try and encourage people to do as much as they can within their comfort zone, and then to expand their comfort zone a little bit, nudge them to being more active. Now, you might find that it's very, very difficult for you to do anything publicly in your own name. You don't have to. One argument that a lot of people give for not taking risks and not getting involved is the very fact that they have a family. And I've always thought that that was a wrong argument. The reason why we have to do this is because we're concerned about our extended family, for those who don't have families, and those who do have their own families, well, this is precisely the reason. They have more skin in the game than most of us, and therefore they need to do things to ensure that their families have it better rather than worse in the future. And there's a great deal of resentment amongst Gen Z people and millennials who realize that their lives are going to be a lot harder and a lot worse than their parents' and grandparents' generation because of the decisions made by their parents and grandparents. Yes. There's a huge amount of resentment building up. I think a lot of that's unfair and unfocused, but it's not entirely unfair. And you don't want to be that kind of person when your kids grow up. You don't want to be part of the generation that the next generation looks back on with hatred because you didn't do enough to change things or because you did bad things to make things worse. Now, nobody who reads Countercurrents is one of the part of the problem, but we can definitely all do more to be part of the solution, and we can do it within the most private and, how to put it, discreet way possible if that's what you need. So I've always had this rule that it's a phrase that comes out of Fight Club. You know, you determine your own level of involvement. You determine how much risk you're willing to take, how far in, how explicit you want to go. And everybody else will have to accept that and respect that. That's, I think, one of the basic rules that will make our movement grow. But by the same token, I will respect whatever you choose, but I'm always going to try and make you expand your comfort zone a little to do more.
Well, it makes me think of how much things can change. I can understand why people feel that way. I mean, 100 years ago, or I think 100 years ago, and certainly 150 years ago, getting a family wasn't really something that was a challenge for most people, because your family would help you to find a partner. And there were certain conventional, you know, methods by which you found a spouse. I mean, this is something that really amazed me when I was living in India, because, you know, that's still the norm there. You know, if you're people don't just meet and fall in love and then get married. I mean, or like in the West today, they do that and then they get divorced 5 years later. But in India, you know, your family and your community, your caste community and your religious community help you to find a partner. And divorce is still very much frowned on in India. It's still, I think their divorce rate is less than 1% when I was living there that I saw.
Wow.
Because not because they're such geniuses at relationships, but because it's such a social stigma attached to getting divorced in India. And it was that way in our culture not that long ago. So, but we don't have these supports anymore. So it's commendable when you do that. But our goal has to be not just to take care of our little corner of reality. We have to transform the culture. Well, I mean, we're never going to be able to transport Western culture magically back in time, 100 or 200 years or whatever. But we have to uphold these values that we defend. And one of them, of course, should be family life. But if you succeed in doing that and you have a family, you raise a healthy family with good values and good beliefs, that's great. But the society around you is still crumbling.
Right.
So you've got to think bigger than that, I think. And we're in a crisis point now. And it's really hard to see. If present trends continue unchecked, I don't see anything but apocalyptic destruction in every form on the horizon. But that's why our movement has arisen, because we're trying to counteract all that.
Mm-hmm.
But to do that, it's not enough to just look after your own. I'm sorry to say that might have been enough 100 years ago. Today, you've got to do more.
Right. So a fellow on Twitter sent in several questions. And I guess since it's on Twitter, it's not like we're doxing somebody because of their public tweets. So someone named Svea Svensson. I think it's a screen name with a Swedish flag. So Svea Svensson had several questions that are, as we say, JQ related. So why don't we go through these? Because I think these are good, solid questions. And really, we could talk a whole long time about just these three questions. First question is, why are many of you white nationalists so hostile to Jews? And is this anti-Semitism directed towards the Jewish elite, like ADL, or Jews in general? Well, one of the things that I learned in politics and just in life in general is something that Carl Schmitt talks about, which is that politics is all about us and them. It's about different teams competing. It's about friend and enemy. And sometimes you don't get to choose your enemy. Your enemy chooses you. And there are quite a lot of people who got involved with the racial nationalist movement and didn't really have any objections to Jews at all. They sort of felt, well, they're just sort of a brand of white people, I guess, like a denomination, like a religious denomination. The idea that Jews in America are any more different from other Americans than, say, Episcopalian Americans or Catholic Americans doesn't really occur to most people, right? They seem like simply Americans, white Americans of a particular religious denomination.
Well, that's a very recent phenomenon. I mean, I don't think certainly my grandparents, who were born at the beginning of the 20th century, they're no longer living. But when I knew them, they certainly didn't see Jews as being white Americans. White Americans.
Yeah.
This is something I think that evolved after World War II.
Well, yeah. Who was the famous fellow who wrote a book about American religion in the 50s? It was a Jewish sociologist. He had a huge influence on, I should have looked this up before we did this, he had a huge influence on denominationalism, I guess is the term. The idea that the differences between religions in America were just becoming sort of differences between denominations within some kind of broader culture. And that's certainly the attitude that I had growing up. You know, I knew that there were these people called Jews, and I thought, well, I'm a Lutheran, they're Jews, you know, I know Catholics, etc. That's the mentality that I was brought up in. And many, many people have that as a default assumption. Now, if you're in Eastern or Central Europe, Jews have had a different message. They've always wanted to be treated not as a religious group, but as a separate people, as a separate nation. But in America, definitely, we've had this idea that there's simply a religious group, a religious denomination, just a different religious group within the broader body of white America. So if you, with that assumption, start talking about American nationalism, and you start talking about anti-white propaganda, anti-white demographic trends, anti-white discrimination in the media and politics and academia and so forth, you're going to find, if you are at all good at noticing patterns, that first of all, people aren't going to be happy when you start talking about these things. You're going to get a lot of pushback, and you're going to notice that there's a pattern in the pushback, and that the pattern in the pushback is that a very disproportionate number of the most passionate opponents of any kind of white identity politics in America are Jews.
Yes.
You're just going to notice that. And so you might not want to choose Jews as your opponents, but believe me, they will choose you as their opponent if you advocate any kind of white identity politics or any kind of nationalism, whether it's American or Canadian or English or British or whatever you want to describe it as, French nationalism. You're going to find that they are going to be in the vanguard of the people who oppose you. And at that point, you're sort of given a choice. And the choice is, do you acknowledge that you've noticed this fact? Or do you just sort of play dumb? Play dumb, play like you're just a dumb, wide-eyed individualist sucker. One of the functions of professing radical individualism in American politics is kind of to signal to people that you're really capable of being suckered. You're a harmless fool. You're a harmless sucker. You're never going to really be part of any kind of team effort or group cause. And therefore, you're signaling to your potential persecutors that they should pass you by, that you're negligible politically. I do think there's a subconscious level on which that is part of the whole profession of being simply an individualist. You're trying to basically communicate that you're a harmless crank that should not be destroyed as an enemy of the establishment. Well, good luck with that. I don't think it's going to do you much good. The other option you've got is to basically say, look, wow, there was this question in the past about the Jews as a distinct people with equal rights and often more than equal rights in many different homelands. And every time that they have this status, there's a question about it. People say, well, wait a second here. They are de facto members of their own community, their own nation, and they're de jure members of our polity with all the rights that attend to that. Isn't there something unfair about that? And isn't there something dangerous about allowing a group that's really loyal to itself primarily
when it's convenient,
when
they're not claiming to speak for us?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
my fellow white people.
Yeah, they're our fellow white people. Yeah, isn't it dangerous to have a group that's international, that's spread out amongst many nations, that is loyal to its own group first, and yet give them access to basically all the privileges of being your in-group, being citizens of your societies? Isn't there something dangerous about that? Aren't you getting yourself into a situation where, for instance, you could perhaps have active lobbying groups involve your country in wars, not for the benefit of your own country, but for the benefit of this foreign people, which we have seen time and time again? World War I, the international Jewish community wanted to gain Palestine as a Jewish homeland from the British Empire. The British Empire and the heads of the Jewish community made a deal. Basically, the deal was they would create the Balfour Declaration and pave the way for a Jewish homeland in Palestine, which was under the control of the British at the time, if the American Jewish community would deliver the United States into the First World War as an ally of the British. Now, they did that. They worked very hard to get the United States involved in the First World War. It prolonged the First World War by a couple of years. God knows how many people died total by prolonging that war for a couple of years. And hundreds of thousands of Americans died. Now, isn't there something dangerous about having people like that in positions of power in your society, or just on conditions of equity in your own society? Isn't there something questionable and dangerous about that? That's why this question is a live question today. Do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of comes down to, this isn't exactly what the question asks, but I feel like it's the direction it's going in, which is that, you know, do we think all Jews are bad? And it's, you know, speaking for myself, of course not. I mean, I recognize there are certain Jews who, for whatever reasons, actually agree with us on pretty much everything. But what I notice about those people is that they never claim to speak for us.
Yeah.
They don't claim to be, they will, I've had Jews and Israelis actually praise me for the sort of work that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also the ones who recognize that they have their interests and we have ours. But
right.
They respect that we're the ones who don't. I met an Israeli once, actually, who was quite frank about the fact that he really despised American and European Jews. And he said, oh, yo, I really respect you because, you know, you don't just swallow the bullshit that they... He's like, we know all about the tricks that they use.
The diaspora and, Jewish tricks. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this was a very right-wing Israeli, obviously,
yeah.
Who I was speaking to. But yeah, he was quite clear that he thought what we were doing was was just great because he didn't like what they were doing either. Because they, another, he was actually a Hungarian Jew I spoke to once, said, well, you know, we oppose what some of our brethren are doing because we recognize in the end that will destroy our identity too.
Right.
You know, exactly. To spread this ideology that we're all the same and all that, you know, in the end, I mean, obviously it won't come till long after we're out of the picture, but it would eventually turn on them as well. And people who are Orthodox, like this guy was, fear that. They don't want to mix. They want to remain who they are, just like we do.
Exactly.
So, but at the same time, we recognize that there are these people, but they're not the ones who were, I mean, there's very powerful forces arrayed against us. I mean, in the U.S., we have the SPLC, you know, which is supported by many Jews. That's our main opponent, I would say. But right after them, you have the ADL.
Yeah.
It's not the NAACP, even though they're a far greater percentage of the population. Who do they always go to when they want to talk about the evils of white nationalism or the right or whatever? It's always the ADL.
Yeah. Yeah.
So these people are, I mean, they very clearly are involved in efforts to try to deprive us of any ability to understand ourselves as having interests and having our own identity.
Right.
And like you said, you can't not notice that without just closing your eyes. And even they, I mean, it's not a conspiracy theory. There's many examples, you know, like this Barbara Spector, she's just one I can think of, who've gone on the record as saying that they think that white people need to be replaced in their own countries.
I mean, and Jews are playing a very important role in this transition.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't things that only we are saying, they are saying it.
Yeah, yeah. The thing about a conspiracy, one thing about a conspiracy is that generally it's kept secret. And there's absolutely no secrecy about this. This is the most open conspiracy in the book. You can read about it in every newspaper. Right. When we talk about it, however, we're accused of giving out a conspiracy theory, which is simply a cheap bit of rhetoric to try and get people to discount what we say. But it's the most open thing in the world. Now, yeah, the question is, are they all that way? No, they're not all that way. But there are dissident Jews. I know some of them. They're really fine people. I really respect them. There are people who claim to be ex-Jews, like Gilad Atzmon. There's Ron Unz. I really respect these people. There are people who support me. You know, there have been are friends to me and have encouraged me over the years, and I am very grateful to them. There's just not enough Jews like this for my taste. And
it's a very small minority.
It's a small minority. And they don't have much power in their own community, and they to their credit, they do stuff, you know, in their community to try and, you know, cool it with the anti gentilic remarks. They do what they can, but they're a very small minority. They're a smaller minority in the Jewish population as we are in the white population, probably even smaller in their population. So yeah, it's the leading organized Jewish community, the leading stratum of the Jewish community with which the vast bulk of Jews will go along. And they're quite active in support. They're one of the most mobilized ethnic communities in the world. There's a great deal of active participation by ordinary Jews in community organizations. And the general direction of this is lobbying for basically identity politics for Israelis and no identity politics for white people. That's the basic hypocrisy that we oppose. My attitude is identity politics for everyone. That's fine. Goy that I am, I believe in, you know, reciprocity and things like that, universal moral principles, etc. And I don't like the double standard, basically. Yeah. That's really what a lot of people object to. Now, there are Jews who object to the double standard too, because they realize that they can't always have a double standard. And, well, there are two views on this. One is that they just think it's immoral to have double standards. And the other thing is they just think it's impractical, that eventually it blows up in their face. And it has, for a very long period of time, blown up in their faces when they do this kind of dual ethics, and they are really, really good at getting it embodied in the whole structure of other societies' laws and policies until people really get tired of it, and then there's a backlash, sometimes a very violent one. So yeah, from a prudential and from a moral point of view, there are certain Jews who think this is a bad thing, but there aren't enough of them to really yet change the direction of Jewish policy. And their voices are always going to be discounted until there's a significant enough amount of pushback from non-Jews. And so that's one of the things that I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, why would they give up something that's working for them? So
why would they give up something that's working for them? Yeah, it's an advantageous relationship. They'll only give it up when it's no longer advantageous, or when it's more advantageous to give it up. And so we have to just continue raising awareness of this problem. I don't think we should, I don't like doing it in a vulgar way. All right, I laugh when people send me happy merchant memes and things like that. I'm not going to be fake about that, but I think that we have to give a rational, morally coherent, morally based, and fact-based case about this, rather than just sound like we're crazy paranoid ideologues. Because that's, first of all, we're not crazy paranoid ideologues. There really is something to this, and this is also the way forward to actually fix this problem somehow. So the second question is, Jews are often accused of playing a key role in the Muslim invasion of Europe, but is it really in the interest of the Jewish minority of our continent to flood it with anti-Semitic Arabs? What do you think of that?
Well, I don't know that we can say that there's only one point of view on this. I mean, even among Jewish groups, there's various camps and schools of thought on this. So I think there are some Jews who are waking up to this fact. I mean, the fact that Netanyahu is so friendly with so many of the nationalist groups in Europe, like Orban and Fidesz, I think it's in part because they do recognize that this isn't good for their diaspora. But again, you know, we were talking about Barbara Spector earlier, and of course there's people like George Soros who've gone on the record as saying that, you know, they think this is great, and that, you know, this is exactly what the West needs. You know, it needs to become less white.
Yeah.
The transformation that we have to make if we're to survive, according to
who's
to
this Ms. Spector. That's surviving, yeah. We don't seem to be surviving this transformation, unfortunately. Yeah.
But so yeah, I think that there's not probably unity among Jews on this question, but generally the most powerful groups are supporting.
Yeah.
I mean, that's clear. Again, it's documented. It's not something that
We're
making up as a paranoid fantasy. There are very powerful Jewish groups and individuals who are aiding this process, and I think it's quite clear. Well, I can't remember where he wrote this now, but there's an essay by Paul Gottfried where he's very openly says that, well, the reason that most Jews support immigration is because they're terrified of our culture.
Yeah.
He was quite open. I mean, I don't think he shares this sentiment. He's describing other Jews. But of course, he tries to justify by saying, well, our experience in Europe, you know, with the pogroms and everything was so terrifying that, of course, we developed this mentality. I don't want to get into all that, but, you know, I think that ultimately that is the reason, that they recognize that our culture and our civilization is the biggest threat to their international design, and they know the only way to put a stop to that is to weaken us by flooding our countries with outsiders.
Right. I mean, let's look at the history of the 20th century. Jews believe that Europeans are so hostile to their interests. European Jews did this. The Zionist movement arose in Europe. European Jews felt that Europeans were so hostile to their interests that they wanted to create a homeland for Jews outside of Europe in the Muslim world. That says to me that Jews feel less threatened in the presence of Muslims than they do in the presence of Europeans. Therefore, Jews would feel less threatened in France or Sweden or any other European country if they opened the doors to Muslim immigration. They would feel less threatened because even though these Muslims hate Jews, they also hate us, and they weaken the ethnic homogeneity and consciousness of these European societies. And that increases the security and relative power of Jews in these societies.
Although I think he does have a point because, you know, for example, in Germany, you'll see these articles, you know, in recent years that say, you know, anti-Semitic attacks in Germany are at an all-time high since the Third Reich. And they're right, but the reason isn't because Germans are carrying out these attacks. It's the immigrants.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So in a way, it is backfiring on them, I think.
It is backfiring on them, but Israeli policy in the occupied territories, in the neighboring countries, ensures that there's a certain amount of terrorism directed at Israelis and that Israelis are going to die because of these policies undertaken by their government. And yet, their government undertakes these policies anyway. Why do they do this? Because they think that on balance, these policies are good for the Jewish collective and they're willing to take a few losses. Now, I think they are just as cold and calculating, perhaps even more so, about Jewish losses in the diaspora. So it is judged as more advantageous for Jews collectively that there be a large, hostile community of Muslims in France than if France were more homogeneously French. And they recognize that there will be some casualties and some costs to these policies, but they still think that it's worth it on balance. I think that that's the kind of calculation that's going on. And therefore, it is perfectly logical to think that they are doing what they are, in fact, explicitly doing.
Yes.
It's really quite open. The organizations that oppose Islamophobia, what are those organizations? Well, the Anti-Defamation League in the United States, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is a de facto Jewish organization, not only in terms of their significantly Jewish staffing, but the fact that their whole paradigm is a Jewish-created paradigm about multiculturalism and group relations in America.
Isn't in France, isn't it this SOS Racisme?
Yeah, and there's also something called LICRA, I think. The A in LICRA is Contra Anti-Semitism. They're very concerned about Islamophobia, too. So it's not really a question that these Jewish organizations and Jewish-dominated organizations and organizations that push forward a Jewish paradigm of multiculturalism are actively encouraging multiculturalism and Muslim immigration in particular. And I do think that you can make sense of it based on their history and their assumptions. They left Europe by the millions to live in the midst of Muslims. They're more comfortable around Muslims than they are around white people. Even though some of these Muslims might hurt them, they're more comfortable around them than they are around us. And that speaks volumes. I think that Jews are perfectly aware that Jewish schoolboys are being beaten up by Muslim youths, right, in France, but they're still more comfortable around them than they are around us. That really speaks volumes. Now, the third question, in Europe, several Jews play an active role in the national populist movements against mass immigration. Shall we regard these Jews as infiltrators or allies? Well, not all Jews, right? There are Jews who are on the right side of this, And the question is, do we regard these people as infiltrators or allies? Well, it depends on how they behave.
Right.
Frankly, I do think we have to be a little suspicious, because we have instances in the past of people who basically control the opposition. And once they come to control the opposition, then they basically neuter it. That is a definite possibility here. And we have to be very, very careful about that. However, that being said, perhaps these people are sincere. To the extent that they're actually helping, I think that, well, there's nothing I can do about it, but I do think that we should be suspicious. And if they're really sincere about helping us, and they're really honest about patterns of Jewish political behavior, they should be very sympathetic to our suspicions. They should be the first people to grant that, yeah, I recognize there's something a little fishy about this, but here I am and I want to help, right? I do think that, that's not an unreasonable attitude for them to have, or it's not an unreasonable attitude to ask them to have. Okay, you're here, but I regard you with a certain amount of suspicion just because of the behavior of other people like you.
Right.
But surely you can understand that. And if you want to help, we'll accept your help. That's the reasonable attitude that I think we should take.
It was interesting, too, you know, 2 years ago in 2017, in the summer, it was the run-up to the Hungarian national elections. And there was a period where every billboard not just in Budapest, but in all the towns and cities of Hungary, the government paid to plaster them all with these posters that featured a photo of George Soros laughing.
Mm-hmm.
And in Hungarian, the slogan next to it was, don't let Soros have the last laugh.
Right.
And the press immediately, not just in the leftist press in Hungary, but all in Europe and the world, started going to town and saying, oh, this is just, you know, clearly anti-Semitic
what
propaganda.
A coincidence, right?
And then about a week later, Netanyahu paid the first state visit by an Israeli leader to Hungary since the communist times.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't address that controversy specifically, but it was interpreted widely, and I think this is true, that he was tacitly supporting Orban in his conflict with Soros over this. And I don't know, you know, I don't know a huge amount about what went on, but I mean, I know there were some agreements that Orban agreed to allow, you know, some Jewish cultural initiatives in Hungary. I don't know the details on that, so maybe they did get something in return. But still, I think Netanyahu probably helped Orban more than Orban helped him.
Right.
So that was an example of something positive for a right-wing movement. Because Hungary is pretty isolated within Europe right now.
Right.
They have the support of a lot of the dissident right-wing movements, but not of too many governments outside of Poland.
Poland, the Czechs, the Slovaks.
Yeah.
But even with the Slovakians, there are tensions because they share a border.
Right.
Yeah.
But in terms of like Western Europe, you know, and the really rich, powerful countries, they're not getting any support from those quarters. So they need it where they can get it. And, you know, I'm not trying to say Netanyahu is one of us or anything like that, but he did do something positive for a European right-wing party that's actually in power.
Right.
So, yeah, you just have to take these things on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, I'm going to say something that will be taken out of context and used to attack me, but frankly, there is going to be a time, if there are national populist governments that arise, where suddenly we're going to have to make a deal with the Jews. I'm putting that in a provocative way, in this sense that they're not all going to disappear. Are they going to have international relations with other countries? Will they have relations with Israel? Will they perhaps end up voting on Israel's side in something in the United Nations? These things would happen. These things would actually happen. These questions would actually be raised if there were ethno-nationalist governments. And at that point, I think people would be making pragmatic deals. They would be saying, well, you know, what can you do for us? There'd be a quid pro quo basis here, which would be worlds apart from the kind of situation where we got now, where our president, Mr. Art of the Deal, gives the Jewish community all kinds of stuff without any strings attached and gets nothing from them. Billions of dollars to Israel, the Golan Heights, moving the embassy, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, what about our wall? No, you can't have a wall. No, you can't have a country. He's gotten almost nothing back. If there were ethno-nationalist, national populist governments living in a world where there's an Israeli state and a Jewish diaspora, and they actually have power, they would end up having to receive a delegation from the ADL. One of the most hilarious episodes of Yoav Shamir's movie, Defamation, is the Ukrainian government at the time having to receive a delegation from the Anti-Defamation League in New York, as if they're like a foreign power, which they are, right? The point is that there are some people in our movement whose attitudes are basically premised on the idea that, well, first of all, their attitudes are basically premised on the idea that we're never going to have power, and therefore we're never going to have to make any decisions about things like this, right? Or they're based on the idea that somehow they'll wake up one morning and all the Jews on planet Earth will have disappeared. In short, their ideas are based on completely counterfactual assumptions, things that are never going to happen. Unrealistic assumptions, yeah. So yeah, I think though that if there is going to be a situation where national populist governments are in power, the very least they can do is demand some kind of reciprocity in their dealings with these people. I think that will happen someday, because I think the wave of the future really is for Europe, and maybe for the European diaspora around the world, these European colonial societies, that national populism is going to be the future. And once we have nationalist governments that take our own nation's interests first and think about our broader race and get their priorities straight, they are going to have to deal with the Jewish entity in the Middle East. Let's hope that it's put on a quid pro quo basis. Back to the question, in Europe, there are Jews who play an active role in certain national populist movements. And I think that we should worry that these people might be infiltrators. And we should not ever put that possibility aside. But if people actually are trying to help, and they seem to be trying to help and not to subvert the direction that things are going, I can't really say, especially if it's not my country, I can't really say that they shouldn't be doing this. But by the same token, I do think that a question mark should hang over these people. And I think if these people are really honest, that they recognize that that's a natural thing and they wouldn't really hold it against us. If they're there to help, then presumably they're there to help under the assumption that there are going to be certain costs and certain difficulties that are thrown in their way to help. I think that they probably have taken that into account.
Well, also, I think that if they are going to help us, they also have to recognize that they're not us.
They're not us.
They speak for us.
Yeah, they don't speak for us. Yeah, and that's really the most important question. If they're presenting themselves as Jewish allies of such and such group, that's great. I am an ally of the Tigers. I want to save the Tigers, but I'm not a Tiger. If I started speaking about my fellow Tigers should get really suspicious. Maybe want to swat me with their big claws, you know? If people want to help us who are not us, they should at least recognize that they aren't us and they don't really speak for us, but they can help us.
And this isn't just Jews, but any other ethnic group.
Any other ethnic groups. And yeah, and let's talk about this. We've mentioned this before. There are non-whites who are supporters of our cause. I take them seriously. I think they're sincere. They've done solid things. And they don't try to change our message. They don't want to change our message. They want to amplify our message. They want to help our message. And when I see that, I think, well, that is a sign of sincerity.
Yes.
These are all really good questions. We will do this again. I think this is going to be a regular feature. We'll alternate occasionally with interviews and things like that. But I like this format. There's been a really positive response to it. And if you have questions, just email them to me at editor@countercurrents.com. That's editor@counter-currents.com. And just put in the subject line, Ask Countercurrents. Yeah, and if you have questions, comments, if you think that we're just completely wrong, please let us know. Scroll down and leave a comment, and we can continue the conversation that way. So thank you, and we'll be back next week for another episode of Countercurrents Radio.